direct you. Peter asked him, I don't want you breaking the plane or this truck.
I wanted to drive the stair truck, Paul said from the back seat.
Well, you should have gotten out to jumpstart it then. You don't get the fun when you don't put in the work.
Emily mock chastised him.
Maybe Tony will let you drive it when we're done.
Funny, Paul replied. Very funny. She followed Antonio's stairs down the runway towards the large grouping of planes.
John and Solange are right. We have two planes.
Hopefully one of them will work, Peter said upon seeing the two 777s.
Instead of backing the truck against the plane, Peter suggested they park the stairs parallel to the door. He did not want to take a chance of hitting or denting the plane or ruining the stair truck. He could get into the cabin from the side of the stairs. He directed Antonio to the right spot before running up the stairs to the jet's door.
Do we need a key or something? Paul asked, coming up behind Peter.
Peter looked at him with as close to a really expression as the polite man could give.
No, these do not get stolen very often. We need to use our muscles and twist this handle.
A circle with a bar running through it, similar to a Greek letter theta, was recessed into the side. Paul noticed a metal catch that held the handle into a locked position. He pushed the catch up, like he would the safety on a gun, and turned the circular handle to his left for half a rotation. The safety button clicked back into place, and the seal on the door made a noise like opening a new jar of pickles.
Nice work! We're in!
Peter patted him on the back. The door pulled out a few inches and slid to the side. They were next to the cockpit. Peter saw the rubber floor of the steward's area.
It smells a little stale, but other than that...
The level of the stairs was equal to the floor of the plane. One by one, they stepped into the cabin. Peter went to the cockpit with Antonio. The others checked the cabin areas.
Holy moly, this plane is big, Emily said. I mean, seriously, we should have enough room, don't you think?
Yeah, we're good.
Paul looked around the steward's cabin. It was fully stocked.
I bet this plane was supposed to take off and was grounded.
It probably has a full tank.
He looked at Meredith. She sat in a first-class seat.
Meredith, let's go in the back and check the cargo hold.
Anyone want to see if there's luggage back there?
This plane might have been boarded, or had people sitting in the terminal waiting to board.
Meredith jumped out of her chair and made her way to the back. She had flown before, but only to Orlando from Newark. She had never been on a plane this large. She eyed the next area of seats.
If that was first class, what's this? She asked.
Business class, Emily told her.
What does that mean?
Another way for the airlines to make money, Paul told her. The cabin lights came on. Paul and Emily cheered. They yelled louder when the engines started. They were in the back and did not see Antonio jump out of the plane to move the stair truck and drive the Suburban towards the terminal. Paul, Meredith, and Emily were searching the cargo hold when Peter stuck his head through the door.
They were going to leave. Must have been stopped.
There were hundreds of stowed bags.
Why wouldn't they give people their stuff back, I wonder?
It was a weird time. I would have gotten out of Dodge, not cared about my luggage, Paul told him. I know the Cincinnati airport was closed.
It just closed. I read on a blog it was nasty. Armed troops in hazmat masks throwing everyone out. People were told to leave without their things.
We can go through the luggage if you like, but I'd just as soon lighten our load, particularly if we're taking cows. Cows are heavy.
We aren't taking the cows, are we? Paul asked.
We're not?
Then why is Kelly trying to save them? Emily asked back.
Because that is what she does. At least that's what I assumed.
I mean, I guess we can take the cows.
Dairy's a good thing.
We know there are cows in Hawaii, right?
There are wild pigs and chickens, too, Meredith chimed in. I was reading a book about Kauai at the library during school yesterday.
She continued to give facts and grinned as she talked about the island.
Emily enjoyed seeing her smile.
Like so many of the tribe, Meredith emerged from her shell the longer she was in Hanover.
The reason I came back here was to tell you that I'm putting the plane in reverse to jockey down the runway towards the terminal. You need to find a seat and buckle up. It might be a little bumpy as I take this baby over grass and up and down the runway edge. He looked at Meredith. I need a co-pilot.
Okay, she said, dropping her head from shyness.
Meredith looked over to Emily. The young girl's eyes blazed with excitement. She followed Peter up front. The old man moved quickly, and Meredith had to hurry to keep up.
"Well, Emily, I suggest taking our seats in first class."
They shut the cargo door and walked back towards the front of the plane.
"I didn't realize we were taking the cows. That was dumb of me.
Are they going to walk up the stairs and onto the plane? Are they going to walk down the stairs in Hawaii?"
Paul had logistical questions, which he continued to ask Emily after they took their seats.
"You worried at all about this?" Emily asked him, ignoring most of Paul's questions.
"About taxiing to the terminal?
I question why we're taxiing to the terminal when we can just leave the plane here."
"No, about flying to Hawaii."
"Yes. I'm scared, but it's the right thing to do. If it works out half as well as we think, we'll be able to survive. If things work out half as well as we think in Hanover, we die. If they work out half as well as we think in Virginia, we're barely eking out an existence."
"How do you mean?"
The plane bumped up and down as Peter pulled backwards and jumped the runway curb. "Let's say we get to Hawaii. It's warm all the time, so we don't have to worry about weather. There's water. There are animals. Hawaii presents a lot of givens. There are some variables, like can we grow crops or catch enough fish? But the givens are tropical fruit trees, tropical vegetables, things that are already there. Right? We can't screw that up. We can't stop avocados from growing all over the place."
"Okay," Emily replied in a leading voice.
"In Virginia, it gets cold and things die. We'd have to can and cure for the winter months. We have to figure out how to fish all year around. We get a blizzard or something? We could be sucked in, screwed. Do we survive? Yes. Does it suck? A whole bunch. Those things won't happen in Hawaii. It would be, and I say this with complete confidence, impossible for us to starve to death in Hawaii. Literally, impossible for us to starve. In Virginia, we could starve. Up here, it's a better bet we starve than don't starve, particularly in 3 to 5 years. In 5 years, we have to be able to grow and kill all our food. How are we going to do that in New Hampshire?"
"That makes sense," she agreed.
"I'm afraid. I'm afraid we'll fall out of the sky. I'm afraid we won't be able to land over there, or we'll have to land in the water, or we'll meet a number of bad scenarios. But once we get there, once my fears have come unrealized, we have set ourselves up for thrivival."
"Thrivival?" she asked.
"You like it? Combining thriving and survival?"
"It's my word.
Hawaii is thrivival. Virginia is survival. And New Hampshire is most likely death."
"Why do you need to make up a word?"
Emily and Paul thrust forward ever so slightly as Peter put on the brakes. The intercom buzzed. "Sorry about that, folks. Came in a little hot. Welcome to Manchester International Airport. It is 10 a.m. local time. If you don't mind, I'm going to run a few quick tests on the engines. You'll hear some revving, and it might get a little loud. I'll let you know when I'm done."
"He's funny," Emily commented.
"I think he wants us to trust that he's a real pilot. I hope to God he's a real pilot.
Shit, I could do the pilot impression."
They heard the engines come up, revving loudly. They were halfway down the runway, still 100 yards from the terminal. The plane moved forward and began to pick up speed. The engines revved down and the plane slowed. Peter kept a steady pace until they arrived at the terminal. "This concludes our flight for today. Thank you for flying Reinhardt Air." Paul yelled towards the cockpit. "Peter, don't turn the plane off yet. I have an idea I'd like to run by you." He unbuckled and walked to the front. Meredith and Peter wore giant headphones.
"Nice," Paul told them.
Peter, he continued, how hard would it be to get the plane up against a gate at the terminal?
Pretty easy, but we still need to move the bridge from the terminal to the side of the plane.
If we want cows and pigs and goats and supplies, all those things will be easier to load from a ramp than a staircase. If we can get a ramp over to the side, like we're truly boarding this plane, well, that will be a great thing. Plus, we can pull back and take off, not worry about a chair truck sitting next to us.
The chair truck would not be an issue, but I get where you're going. Most of your scenario depends on us being able to get power to the terminal and to one of those telescoping ramps to the plane.
We can get a generator to make the telescoping happen. Just park the plane where you would normally put it. Paul gave Meredith a thumbs up. And you keep doing what you're doing. Great work. She giggled. The oversized headphones slipped off her ears.
You got it. Hold on. I might bump into something I don't see on the ground, but that's okay. Typically a jumbo jet wins confrontations.
Peter pulled the jet towards the last terminal spot 10 yards from a telescoping ramp. Antonio retrieved the stair truck, jogging all the way back to the end of the runway. He parked near the plane door.
Before we get out, let's check supplies.
We have enough chips, crackers, and cookies to hold us for a while.
Emily spoke from the first-class steward closet. We also have booze, water, soda, and orange juice.
The fuel gauge reads full, Peter added. We have enough to get us to Hawaii and back to California if we need it.
Let's unload the luggage and head back home. This was a successful trip. He shook Peter's hand and gave Meredith and Emily high fives.
Based on your opinion, we could leave tomorrow? He asked Peter.
We could leave tomorrow. I want to get a good night's sleep. It's been a long time since I flew for 12 hours, but yes, we could go wheels up tomorrow if we needed to do it.
Do you know how to open the luggage door to get the bags out? Emily asked him as they made their way to the back of the plane.
I do, but we're going to need a little luggage ramp car to access it.
I love those things, Meredith laughed. It'll be just like Toy Story 2.
51. We have a pilot, a plane, fuel, and a clear runway. Emily ceded the return driving to Paul. Antonio assumed shotgun. Peter was curled up in the back seat for a nap. Meredith sat next to Emily and listened.
Check, she responded.
It's supposed to snow tomorrow. Gray clouds hung low over the area and the air felt heavy. Rebecca's prediction was going to come true.
Check.
Emily enjoyed the check responses.
We have to move supplies and what we want to take. We have to move the animals. And we leave.
Check. Meredith nodded with finality. Emily pulled a notebook from the pocket in front of her seat. She made a list of supply items. There were 3 lists. Wants, needs, haves.
Peter, she asked, knowing he was still awake. If we can get into a warehouse and find food, how much weight can the jet handle?
With no people? Unless you're putting the entire warehouse in, I don't see a problem. If we get a herd of cattle, then we have another conversation.
Thank you.
Emily made notes. She wanted rice, beans, pasta, and canned food. Similar lists were being made by everyone in the tribe. It helped them pass the time. Meredith read the list from the next seat.
We need seeds.
Emily looked at her.
I'm sorry, honey, what was that?
Most of what you're writing should be in the wants category. We need seeds more than anything else. We have to grow things, lots of things. Cans are heavy and will go bad. We need to learn how to live off the land.
We have to survive once we get there, Emily told her.
We need to take as much food as we can.
Sure, but not so much that we need a warehouse. There's going to be food there.
Craig can catch fish for us. She giggled. Craig had the reputation of being the best angler.
We should take livestock and food, but not so much that we raid a warehouse. We can't live like the past. We need to look at the future. We need to grow, hunt, harvest, fish.
The young girl stopped talking. She felt uncomfortable speaking to an adult so candidly. Emily looked at the young woman. There was silence in the car. Paul and Antonio glanced at each other with a look men have when they're uncomfortable, particularly when the situation involves two women.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
Emily balled up her piece of paper. We need seeds and livestock. We probably need a month of food to take, and maybe a little more to help us on days we don't catch fish. But Meredith is right. I need to start thinking like it is, not how I want it to be, or how I've been living for the last few months. She winked at Meredith. You keep telling me when I'm wrong, when I'm living in the past. Meredith gave her a simple check in reply.
You gonna tell her the other problem?
Antonio spoke over his shoulder to Meredith.
About the talk we all had?
Emily looked up from her pad and faced her young friend. What is it?
Some of us don't want to go, Meredith admitted.
What? Paul responded from the driver's seat. We have to go. Our lives depend on going.
Dude, it's not like we don't want to go to Hawaii. I want to lie in the sun and catch fish and crap, but you're old. You're going there to retire. I'm 17. Who am I going to be with? How am I going to live my life once the old are a lot older? We don't have enough people.
Who doesn't want to go? Emily asked Meredith.
Avery, Antonio, and I have talked about it. It's like he just said. I want to stay with the group, but my prospects are rotten if we don't find other survivors. I'm not sure Bernie wants to go either. Kelly is getting the cows healthy and hopes it will convince people to stay here. I don't know Dan and Karen well enough yet.
Tell you what we can do, Peter yelled from the back. We can go over, and if we think it makes sense, I can fly back to San Francisco, Los Angeles, or Tokyo for that matter. We aren't just considering Americans, right?
Antonio yelled back.
What do you mean we can come back?
Emily turned around in her seat to see Peter.
Would it be possible to drop paper from a 777 flying over cities?
Possible or advisable, was his response.
Maybe we can fly over cities and drop paper, notes to have people meet us in San Francisco or Los Angeles to get picked up in a month.
Let me think about it. We might be able to find Antonio some women yet.
Peter worked the problem in his head. Maybe they could put leaflets in the landing gear and fly low over Chicago, opening the landing gear to release the notes. He smiled as he formed the plan in his head.
We need to decide what cities.
I'll make it work, he said to Emily and Meredith.
I wouldn't mind finding some additional women.
Antonio cracked a smile. I always want to increase my odds. He may have matured, but he still relied on occasional swagger.
You know what I mean, Paul?
He gave the driver a punch on his upper arm.
I think we all know what you mean, Tony.
Paul did not comment beyond the acknowledgement.
You know what we need to do? We don't want to land. We just want people to figure out how to join us, right? We could drop leaflets or something and tell people where we're going.
Antonio paused.
If you can't figure out how to get to us, I'm not sure I want you joining the tribe, right? You gotta earn your spot on Team Antonio.
We're not calling it Team Antonio, Paul said to him immediately. There aren't any proposed tribe names, but if there are, Team Antonio would not make it on the list.
You know it would.
Antonio backed up his comment.
No, it wouldn't. I'd vote for the Lollipop Guild before Team Antonio.
You'd rather be the Lollipop Guild? Some Wizard of Oz crap before Team Antonio? That's cold. Damn cold, Paul.
Paul drove quickly towards Hanover. Small flakes of snow fell, melting on the windshield.
I miss NPR, Paul said as the conversation paused for a few minutes. It was great to drive and listen to stories about beavers or religion.
I liked All Things Considered, but their weekend shows were horrible. Who could listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Crap?
Antonio shook his head as he mentioned the show.
You liked NPR?
Paul looked over at him. I'm supposed to be ignorant on national and world topics just because I'm in a gang? Some of those stories were good.
Tony, you are a man of surprising depth and intelligence, Paul complimented him.
Yes, I am, he told Paul. Yes, I am.
They rolled into Hanover at 2 p.m. during a driving snowstorm. It hit early, a day before Rebecca forecast. She saw potential for an early storm, but the models presented a low probability for Tuesday and higher for Wednesday. Weather is an imperfect science, she told them, her hands upturned and out to her side.
52. Snow in April. Why did you bring us here, Todd?
Melanie was not happy. Neither was Solange. The temperature was back in the low 30s.
It will all be gone by Thursday, don't worry. It should warm up, Rebecca assured everyone. Until then, we can hunker down, cozy up next to the fires.
During the scouting trip to the airport, the Hanover group made plans for the spring snowstorm. They acquired and set up two ping-pong tables in the basement of the Choate Road house. Teams were drawn at random, and a tournament bracket was put on the wall. The games ran all day Wednesday. There were singles and doubles divisions, and an under-12 age group. It was not a fair tournament. Avery dominated the singles side of the competition and carried her partner Jamie through the doubles. There was outcry throughout the house, accusations of sandbagging the event, withholding information. But in the end, Avery was declared the singles and doubles ping-pong champion.
Next time you have to play left-handed or something like that, Dan said to her after his drubbing in the semifinals.
I could use my backhand exclusively. But wouldn't it humiliate you more when I still win? She had her paddle facing down, making a sweeping motion towards him, shooing him away.
You just made an enemy.
He put two fingers pointed towards his eyes, then pointed them back at her.
Watch your back next tournament.
Dan was her most competitive match, which Avery still won 21-11. Regardless of the domination by one player, the event was successful and fun. The 12 and under bracket used a smaller table. Jacob and Brian played a thriller in the final match, with Brian winning 21-19.
We have to get a pool table, Paul told John as they sat and watched Rebecca play Matt.
We need a pool table, maybe a dartboard, some backgammon. We should make a true rec room.
We're not staying here that long, remember?
Maybe you can find a pool table and use it at that location. It would be a lot easier than hauling one in here.
John's head bobbed back and forth with the ball.
We're so busy, too. Would be hard to find time to help me, Paul replied sarcastically.
Did you know the young people are reluctant to move?
Meredith, of all people, talked to us about it in the car. It's not that they don't want to move to Hawaii. It's the finality of their numbers. They want more of an effort put into finding survivors before we isolate the tribe.
What did you tell her? John asked him before yelling, Oh, nice point, Matt.
It was not a close match. Matt was better than Rebecca.
I didn't answer. Emily suggested a plan on our way to Hawaii. We'll fly over large cities and drop flyers from the landing gear.
John nodded, still watching the game. Paul was surprised his brother was blasé about the idea of losing half of the tribe, particularly the younger half.
I completely agree with him. We need more people. But we're up against a clock. I have no idea how long the plane will work. I don't know how long the cars will work. We have to get to Hawaii before the end of summer. We've traveled up and down the East Coast. I've made a specific trip to Boston. If they still want to leave... We can't stop them.
John turned away from the match.
But I'll do everything I possibly can to appease their concerns, help them find additional survivors, and convince them that we are executing the best and only option for survival by going.
Paul nodded.
Hey, did you know we were taking the cows with us?
Yeah. Why wouldn't we take the cows?
What did you think Kelly was doing over there the last 5 days?
Apparently, she's one of the dissenters with regards to leaving, and is possibly creating a food source for the people who stay here. But
I also just assumed she's a vet, and vets heal animals.
Do you not want to take the animals?
I do. It just seems funny. Very Noah's Ark. We have a dog, chickens, goats, cows, pigs, and people, and we're all flying to paradise.
So we hope, John told him. So we hope.
Matt won match point. John screamed, "Yes!" It was early in the tournament. Paul turned to his brother. Have you seen Avery play?
No, John said, standing up to congratulate his son.
Why? She as good as Matt?
Save me a seat if they play each other. I want to make sure I'm next to you for that one.
Paul put his hand on John's back and gave him a pat. John looked at the board.
Actually, I'm playing her next. Maybe you want to stick around and watch me?
Paul smiled. I wouldn't miss it, John. Wouldn't miss it for the world.
Paul sat back down and watched the match. It lasted less than 10 minutes, 21-3.
John's 3 points came on Avery's double faults.
The temperature rose in the late afternoon. The snow became a drizzling rain. Fog and mist enveloped the roads and landscape. A pot of moose chili bubbled on the sun porch wood stove, and cornbread baked quickly in a cast-iron skillet.
Do you have any idea how tired of moose meat we're going to be in another few days?
Hank ate his chili next to Kelly.
Well, it's food. It's good food. And there aren't any moose in Hawaii, so realize this is the last time in your life you will ever have moose meat.
I'm upset we wasted the smell of cornbread and chili on a screened porch.
She took another bite. The chili was delicious, regardless of it being the 6th meal in a row of red meat.
It might be the last red meat you have in a long time, too.
There are pigs, fish, and fowl in Hawaii. I know there are cows, but cows don't go feral as well as the other animals.
I'll try to breed, but, you know.
So you're telling me to eat up?
Hank pushed another spoonful into his mouth.
More telling you to stop complaining.
Kelly laughed as she watched a fake smile spread across Hank's face while he ate. They worked together at the dairy farm over the last few days, getting to know each other better. She was fast friends with the older man. They both enjoyed punk music in its many versions. Double Nickels on the Dime by the Minutemen was Kelly's favorite album. Hank had nothing but respect for her after she told him.
When do you think we'll leave? I heard the plane works and is full of fuel.
Kelly switched topics.
I don't know. You and I have to get those cows healthy.
Probably another week or two, right?
He ate some of his cornbread.
Yeah, I'd say.
They don't have to be 100%, but I want them a little stronger before we move them.
The pigs are probably fine. They'll sleep like hubba. No worries.
She paused.
So, I'm the holdup? Or do you think people still want to stay and relax?
A little of both.
Don't rush. We have nothing but time.
Did you hear the latest plan?
Hank tore into a second triangle of bread.
To eject pamphlets from the plane. Fly over most of the major cities.
I've heard pieces. If we can make it happen. Sounds good to me.
I'm one of the people voicing concerns about the small size of our tribe and how we need more young people. Once I get to Hawaii, I don't plan on coming back. If this helps us ease our conscience, possibly rescue some people by setting them on a path towards us, I'm all for it.
Yeah, I agree on all fronts.
Hank finished his meal.
There's cake tonight. Want me to grab you a piece?
Pockets of people ate and spoke in groups around the Choate Road mansion.
Who doesn't like cake?
Kelly asked rhetorically. Todd watched the rain wash away the snow. Emily came up behind him and slipped her arm around his back. He looked through a window in the den converted into Hank and Paul's bedroom. The fire smoldered behind him.
What you thinking?
She asked him.
That this is the last snowfall I will ever see. I always thought, or dreamed at least, that you and I would spend some of our retirement in New England. That we would enjoy the leaves changing color. That our grandchildren would go sledding on the same hill I used as a boy.
He turned to look at her, kissing her. But I will have grandchildren, so I'm not sad. I'm just enjoying the last snow. She put her other arm around his front, hugging him from the side. She watched the rain with her husband. You know, I was never going to retire to New England, right?
Yes, he said back.
I hate the cold.
I know.
I love you. Emily squeezed him tightly. I love you so much. It was a great idea for us to come up here. We found family and new friends. You saved us.
I know, he said jokingly and without modesty.
I did it for selfish reasons, too. I didn't know at the time why I was sending us here. It was a bad idea, believing we could live in Hanover forever. But it has let me say goodbye to my town. It's brought us friends and a path to our new life. I can leave Hanover in a few weeks, remembering my childhood, my boyhood home fondly. I'll always remember it like this. Beautiful. He turned and kissed her again. And I'll always remember our last snowfall. Todd smiled as he turned and looked back out the window.
53. The weather turned warm, just as Rebecca forecast. Antonio was able to hotwire a car battery to the ramp extension near their airplane. He moved the walkway and attached it to the side of the plane. He would pull it back a few feet just before takeoff and use a board to walk across the gap. With the ramp attached and a conveyor truck in place to load the cargo luggage hold, tribe members made trips to Manchester to load items. They packed seeds, fishing gear, feed for the livestock, rice, pasta, canned goods. They took clothing and shoes, blankets and sheets, bleach, water, soda, and batteries. Peter gave parameters on weight, but the load limit he set was high. He, Jamie, and Hubba never left Hanover. Seats were removed from coach to accommodate the animals. Metal fencing was installed to keep the different species corralled. Dan was the only tribe member to spend time in Hawaii. He went every year for vacation, but his family stayed on Maui with only a few day trips to Kauai. He admitted that he did not know much about Kauai specifically, other than seeing a Walmart, walking around a few downtowns, and remembering there were two different climates. The north was green and cool. The south was sunny and hot. "Not much help, am I?" he asked Rebecca as she read through books and asked him questions about the area.
"No, but that's okay. We'll figure it out. It's great to have you as a resource."
Tribe members not packing and traveling to Manchester fulfilled the daily chores necessary to keep the group alive. They fished, purified water, cooked bread, and figured out new and inventive ways to serve moose. Paul, having tired of moose more quickly than the rest, decided to make moose jerky from as much of the remaining meat as he could. He dried and packaged relentlessly. Jerky was easy to store, had a decent shelf life, and it was light in weight. It took him the entire 2 weeks, but he managed to jerkify, as he called it, the last 1.5 moose legs. He personally drove the 100 bags of moose jerky to Manchester. Peter confirmed their plan to spread notes across the country. They would stuff the flyers, thousands of them, near the landing gear. Peter would fly low into the city, let the gear down, and the pamphlets would drop to the ground. They could repeat the procedure as necessary, loading the wheel well in flight. A favorite pastime became running the copiers at the local print shop. A gas generator powered the industrial copier. They created more than 100,000 flyers, all shipped to Manchester and placed near the landing gear wheel well. After a visit to an office supply warehouse in Lebanon, Avery and Meredith took an added step of laminating several hundred copies of the note. Rebecca took great pleasure in calling them nerds. They planned to fly over Chicago, St. Louis, Dallas, Houston, San Antonio, San Diego, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Seattle before turning for the Hawaiian Islands. The note was written in English and Spanish. 20-plus survivors, men, women, and children, we are starting a colony on the island of Kauai, Hawaii. Join us. We will return on August 1st to the San Diego airport to meet survivors.
gather as many people as possible. Hank joked that he wanted to include a phone number and email address. John toyed with adding the line, "No assholes allowed." Days were productive, busy, yet relaxing. If people wanted to take a day off from packing, loading, or working, they did. Jamie was not strong enough to load the plane. She helped with meals, fed the animals, and made herself useful. She read stories to the children at school, giving Emily much-needed breaks. 10 days after the snowstorm, it was close to 60 degrees, and the sun shone brightly. Light, puffy clouds drifted across the pale blue New England sky. Kelly and Hank arrived at the RV for lunch, after spending another night at the dairy farm. "Milk," she said, jumping out of the pickup truck and announcing their latest prize to the group. 3 gallons of real milk! The cows are ready to go!" She walked to the tables near the grill in front of the main house and placed a large metal milk jug on top. Todd turned to John and said 3 simple words. "Time to go." He put his arms out and patted his brother and wife on their backs before walking to the table to congratulate Kelly and Hank for their hard work. John looked at Emily. She nodded. He turned to Solange. She wore a smile on her face. "You heard him. It is time." Solange walked towards the table to have a glass of cow's milk. Most of the preparation for the flight was done. The plane was loaded with supplies. The coach section was converted into a barn with pens and feed for the animals. There were 100,000 copies of their flyer ready to distribute. Even with the massive transfer of supplies to the plane, the Hanover camp did not suffer from lack of food or clothing. The only key piece of equipment missing was Todd's pizza oven, forcing him and Ahmed to use the commercial wood-fired oven in town. "Let's talk time frame and logistics." Hank sat at a large table in the restaurant that night. The sunny start to their day turned cloudy, and a light rain drizzled outside. The tribe enjoyed brick oven-baked fish, French bread baguettes, and roasted canned asparagus. "Kelly and I will make sure the animals get to Manchester and on the plane. We measured the width of the cows, and since they're all pretty skinny right now, they'll make it through the jet doorway with room to spare." Hank prepped a trailer to bring the 5 cows, 1 bull and 8 hogs to the airport. He and Kelly would get them on the plane, sedate the cows and hogs, tranquilize the bull, and be ready to go at least an hour before the proposed takeoff. "I don't want them on the plane too long before us. You know they're going to stink up the place." Melanie did not like the smell of animals. It was a necessary evil for the trip, but she wanted to minimize the problem. "Don't worry. We'll take care of it," Hank assured her. "Sorry a few hours of smell might save your life with food and dairy down the road." Sarcasm was common among tribe conversations, particularly involving Hank. "I'm paying for a first-class ticket. I expect an odorless flight." She smiled. "I'll keep my animals under control. You just keep your kids out of my section." Hank knew it was going to be more difficult to entertain the children for 12 hours than keep the animals at bay. "We all want to go, right?" John asked. "So, let's go." 2 days. We'll run through our checklist of supplies tomorrow and leave the next day." John turned to Peter. Peter was the linchpin, the key to their journey. He made the final decision. "I'm ready. The plane checks out. The supplies are well under weight, even with the livestock. I feel good, strong, well rested. Let's fly." The group did not cheer. They nodded in agreement. Their die was cast. They were leaving Hanover, even though it had become comfortable over the last 3 weeks. The mutiny of young people planning to stay behind in North America was quelled by the flyer-dropping plan. Other ideas emerged to grow the tribe. Ahmed volunteered to remain in North America, zigzagging across the country until August 1st, when he would meet the rescue plane in San Diego. Antonio and Meredith offered to stay behind with him. Rebecca met with them. "Ahmed, even your limited understanding of mathematics must understand that 3 people represents more than 10% of the current tribe. What if you break down and cannot make the August 1st deadline in San Diego?
What if the tribe makes a water landing or lands on a highway landing in Hawaii and cannot find another plane?
Ahmed respected intelligence and rational arguments. He could not refute Rebecca's final statement.
The best and safest way to increase the tribe's numbers, without risking our current members, is to drop leaflets across the country, have all of us fly over, and have Peter return in August. I'll fly until the fuel goes bad or we run out, but we'll find more young people for you, Peter assured them. Peter was in his late 60s, and while strong for his age, he knew his limitations. He used the 10 days to develop a serviceable co-pilot. Flying a plane for 12 hours was not something he wanted to try, particularly with a potentially tricky landing on the back end of the flight. He would need bathroom breaks and a nap. He wanted Antonio to sit in the cockpit while Peter curled up and slept for a few minutes, possibly an hour. Antonio was mechanical and understood gauges and dials. He knew about longitude and latitude beyond the lines on the globe. His years of deep-sea fishing with his father taught him to trust readings rather than his eyes out the window. Antonio could read the instruments, adjust their heading when needed, and keep his cool if any lights came on. Peter took him to Lebanon Airport and sat in the cockpit of the largest available plane, an 18-seat turboprop.
"Okay, Tony. This will be my version of a pool certification for scuba diving you might receive at a resort. It's going to be fast. It's going to be effective. It by no means certifies you to fly a plane without me, and you will most likely forget everything you've learned a week after we land in Hawaii."
Antonio nodded. "I'm going to take off and land the plane. We can talk about landing, but if there's an issue with me on the way over and you have to try and land a 777 without me?" Peter paused.
"Yeah, let's just move on from that scenario. The other thing I want to drum into your head, the plane is going to be on autopilot. The 777 has a system that is advanced, safe, and almost foolproof. It could potentially land the plane for us if needed. I will show you how that works when we get up in the air, but I will be landing the plane myself. All I want you to learn over the next few hours is what to do if the autopilot fails and I'm asleep or in the bathroom."
He paused again for emphasis.
"The autopilot is not going to fail. It just won't. But in the 1 in a million chance that it does, I need you to be able to grab the controls and keep us in the air. That's all we're trying to do here, nothing more. You shouldn't feel any pressure to have to learn how to fly a plane or land a plane. Please just focus on being able to grab the handle and keep us steady until I can get back."
Antonio nodded again. His typical swagger and verbal bravado was noticeably absent.
"I'll say this a few more times, just to make you comfortable. You are completely unnecessary. The autopilot on these planes is incredible. Other than taking the plane out to the end of the runway, I am almost unnecessary. The computer can do everything. I'm the backup for the computer. You're the backup for me. Double redundancy, and you're the redundant backup. It never gets to you. Got it?"
Antonio listened, took some notes, and quizzed himself throughout the week. He had fun taxiing the plane around the little airport, paying attention to which levers did what. Peter was confident he could handle the plane for the minute it might be necessary. Peter sat with Antonio at dinner.
"You ready?"
"Ready to do nothing?"
Antonio replied.
"Exactly."
Peter grinned. "You catch on quickly."
Greg and Rebecca left the dinner together, Greg holding a large umbrella in his left hand, his right arm swung around Rebecca to keep her warm. He enjoyed holding her. They left to spend the night at the coach house. One last night alone in Hanover, the way they started their journey.
"I'm getting excited about the trip," Rebecca told him. "I know you think I'm sad to leave New England, my home, but I'm not. I'm excited to start something fresh."
"Really? Aren't you scared?"
He was scared. Scared of the flight. Scared of what they might find or not find on the islands. His stomach did backflips with increasing speed over the last week.
"I'm not."
Her left arm was around his waist.
"These are good people. Great people.
We're going to build a fantastic tribe that can accomplish anything, overcome any shortcomings we might find. She continued talking as they walked. I'm a planner, you know that. You probably think I'm uncomfortable in a situation I can't control or plan, and normally you'd be right. But not today. I'm ready. I'm an optimist for the first time in my life. I'm looking at the next week as a positive, not a set of odds that I need to calculate. Rebecca's voice was filled with enthusiasm. Your family created this excitement for me. They're so full of hope, so full of life. They're taking this journey by the horns, accepting the downside that might occur, and meeting it head on. I sound like a sports metaphor for the first time in my life. I never talk or think like this, but today, we're ready. We as a group, we as a couple, me as a person, ready to go. Wow, Greg replied after her speech. It's hard to argue with you when you have this much passion. I'm scared. Scared like I was when I decided to leave the dorm last year. I have no idea how this trip is going to go, the actual trip over to the island, and the life we create. I'm going to do it. I'm getting on the plane. It's the right thing to do, but I'm going to hold your hand when the wheels go up. Greg and Rebecca, she said to him quietly. Greg and Rebecca, he said back, pulling her towards him as they walked. Do you think we'll find anyone alive over there? Will someone see our plane in Honolulu and try to come over to Kauai? Do you think anyone will be on Kauai? Greg read the travel guides for the islands, but he did not know the island's population before the plague. What were the odds they found people, or even a person? There should be a person alive. The population is over 1,300,000. I don't know if that means two people made it. We're going to Kauai. Its population is 60,000. That island should be empty, but you never know. We fly low over Honolulu, drop some flyers, make it known we're going to Kauai. I bet Peter will find a small plane he can pilot over to Pearl or something, if he wants to pick up a survivor. Antonio can take a boat. Could you imagine being alone in Hawaii? Literally alone, like you and I were. Only for almost a year. Then a plane flies over your head? If it were me, I would think it was a dream. Greg opened the front door of the coach house and let Rebecca walk through. There was a pre-made fire in the fireplace. She lit it while Greg shook out the umbrella and took off his boots. They had a solar lantern, one of the few left in town that wasn't packed on the plane in Manchester. The fire cast enough light for the room, and Greg clicked it off. It was cool in the room. The evening temperatures were still in the low 50s. Rebecca kept her sweater on until the fire brought up the heat. Greg had a flannel shirt unbuttoned over his long-sleeved crewneck shirt. He sat down on the couch with her. She cuddled into his arm and chest. The fire danced in front of them. They sat quietly and relished their time together. She fell asleep on his chest, and he enjoyed her feeling against him. Greg let her sleep while he watched the fire and worried about the flight. 54.
You're sure this bull isn't going to fall asleep before we get it on the plane? We aren't going to wait for it to wake up, and I don't think we can carry it.
Hank pulled an increasingly groggy black male steer through the Manchester airport.
He'll make it, don't worry. We need to get him on the plane, though, so stop complaining and keep pulling.
Kelly was walking next to the animal, coaxing it along. Hank made it to the gate and walked down the corridor. The bull snorted, raised its head, resisted the enclosed space for a second, and moved forward.
"It's okay, big fella. You're doing great. Keep walking."
The bull slowed to a painstaking trot, but made it to the door of the plane. It pulled its head back, but was drugged enough to be led forward through the door. Hank turned the beast towards the pen in the back of the plane, and after 15 minutes of handling, the large animal was in a chain-linked fence. It blinked a few times, bent its legs to lie down on the ground, and its eyes rolled into its head. His side moved up and down as he breathed. Kelly checked its heartbeat and pulse and gave Hank a thumbs up.
"He's going to be out for a long time, and I mean a long time. If he opens his eyes, I'll hit him up again. But even if he wakes up, he'll be in a daze."
Let's get the cows, the pigs, goats, and chickens. Hank looked at Kelly. I cannot believe I just said that, both from the standpoint of me, a non-farm-type person, and because we're loading a plane to Hawaii full of farm animals. The cows loaded easily. As long as the first one walked, the others followed. Hank put them in an area next to the sleeping bull. The pigs came in a herd to their pen. The goats and chickens were on their way down from Hanover. With their animals loaded, Hank and Kelly sat in first-class chairs, sweaty and ready for a break. "When do we take off?" Kelly asked, exhausted.
"I asked Todd to have the water filled and hot in the RV so we could shower before the flight. I plan on sleeping as soon as we're in the air."
Hank put his hands behind his head. "Everyone should be here soon." Todd pulled up in the RV 15 minutes later. He called Hank on a handheld to say he was outside of the terminal. Todd did not want to expose the kids to the noxious smell from the parking area. He told them to hold their noses and run into the terminal once they saw Hank or Kelly spinning the large revolving door. "They'll come out, and you go in," he told the 10 kids with him. Bernie, Emily, and Melanie nodded in agreement. Hank and Kelly appeared on the other side of the glass windows. They spun the door, and Emily took a big breath, picked up the sleeping bulldog laying at her feet, let Todd open the door for her, and ran the 10 feet into the terminal. The children did the same. Bernie and Melanie went last. Hank and Kelly ran from the terminal into the RV once the kids were inside with Emily.
"Shut the door," Todd yelled. "The smell is incredible."
"Sorry." Hank was sweaty and panting.
"It might be a little from us, too. We've been sleeping with and moving farm animals for 12 hours.
"Are they all set?" Todd asked. "The bull is out, and the rest are sedated for the flight. We're good to go." Kelly looked at Hank.
"I'm going to jump in the shower, if you don't mind. I'm calling girls first on you."
"Please," Hank told her, sitting down on the couch in the RV.
"You do smell," Todd told him.
Dan is driving the other RV with the adults and animals. They were supposed to leave within 10 minutes of me.
"All going as planned? Any problems?"
Hank had been at the farm with Kelly.
"We are amazingly problem-free.
I was sad leaving Hanover, but we're all excited for the journey. It's time to start our lives." Todd looked towards the terminal.
"I better get in there to see if Emily needs any help. Did you get breakfast?"
"Not really," Hank admitted. "I was planning on chips and cookies on the plane." Todd gave him a wink.
"You think I'd let my brother go out like that? We had steak and eggs this morning. I saved you and Kelly some steak, the last of the moose, sliced it with some fresh mozzarella and basil mayonnaise on a baguette I made last night."
He pointed to the oven. "I hid it in there so no one would find it before you two got to eat."
"I love you, man. I really do. I think I might cry."
Hank walked to the oven and claimed his prize, biting into his half of the sandwich as soon as he exposed an end from the plastic bag.
"Don't forget there's a piece for Kelly. It's not all for you."
Todd waited for Hank to nod.
"Okay, I'll see you in a few."
Todd took a breath, opened the door, and ran for the terminal.
"What's for me?"
Kelly asked, coming out of the master bedroom in a senior citizen-style sweatsuit for the flight. Hank held up her half of the sandwich. No words were exchanged. She accepted the food and began to eat. They were ravenous. After a few bites and swallows, Kelly managed a, "Oh my God, this is so damn good." Hank nodded. He was slowing down, his belly full for the first time since he awoke 5 hours earlier.
"I'll be in the shower, out in a minute," he said, getting up from his seat. "I'm not going to lie to you. It feels as great as this sandwich tastes."
Kelly ran a brush through her hair with one hand and held the sandwich in the other. She was right. Hank washed the grime from his body and enjoyed a minute of happiness in the warm water. He turned off the shower, dried himself with a towel, and put on his own senior leisure suit. When he emerged into the main part of the RV, Kelly was gone. Hank ate the last bites of his sandwich as the other RV pulled up behind him. He took a gulp of water from a bottle on the table and ran into the terminal. Hank did not go to the plane. He waited for the people to come out of the RV. Peter ran into the airport first. He said hello and made his way down to the plane for his pre-flight systems check.
One by one, the people came out of the RV and into the terminal. John, a bandana wrapped around his nose and mouth, opened the animal trailer and led the goats into the terminal. Solange, also sporting a bandana, ran to the animal trailer and grabbed two cages of chickens. She handed a cage to Avery.
"It's not as bad as I remember," John said to Hank as he waited with the three goats. "But it's still pretty damn bad. There are 10 chicken cages. Everyone needs to grab one."
John grasped Solange's empty hand, and they walked towards the ramp leading the goats. Hank, Paul, Dan, and Ahmed took turns running out to the trailer for chicken cages. Once inside, they handed the cages to a waiting person. Dan came back with the last cage.
"That's it," he said, gasping from holding his breath. "It's empty."
The chickens beat their wings against the cages. The rooster crowed. Paul looked at his brother Hank. "Nice sweatsuit, Grandpa."
"I bet I can sell this to you in 6 hours. Comfort is key on a long flight."
He showed off his moccasin slippers. "I have a set on the plane. I'm making fun of you while I can." Paul picked up a chicken cage and walked towards the plane. Hank fell in step next to him. "We've come a long way from me finding you in a hole."
"We have." Hank put his free arm around him. "I know we aren't there yet, but..."
There was a tear in his eye.
"I feel like we made it, Paul. We made it through this whole damn mess."
From a hole in Ohio to a snowy bed and breakfast in Vermont, we made our way onto a plane bound for Hawaii. Paul shared his brother's sentiment. The ticket price was too damn high. But we made it. Dan walked behind them, chicken cages held out to his sides in each hand.
"We're going to get a ticket leaving those RVs in the fire lane," Ahmed said to the men.
"I can get you out of most tickets in New England," Dan replied over his shoulder. "I'm pretty popular with law enforcement."
They walked upstairs to their gate at the end of the terminal.
"I swear, I'm always the last gate."
Dan shook his head in mock anger.
"Could be worse. We could be in Minneapolis or Atlanta," Paul responded.
"Honestly, Dan, when was the last time you were in the public side of an airport?"
"It's been a while. I remember them being more crowded and the security being tighter."
He smiled at his own joke. They arrived to a plane full of noisy children, adults, and animals. Peter greeted them, escorting Dan and Paul towards the back.
"Hand the chickens to Avery and Matt. I want to show you my plan for the flyers."
The adults were in first class, the children occupied business class, and the animals crowed, oinked, bayed, and mooed in coach. Peter walked through a door to the cargo area and stopped when he reached a door handle in the floor.
"See this?"
Peter twisted the handle and opened the trap door. Light from the outside glowed from below.
"This is the access panel to the landing gear, which is down, obviously. You can see the outside at the bottom of the wheel well. When we're in flight, the wheels will tuck in here."
Peter pointed towards the stacks of printed paper in piles next to the trap door.
"When the wheels are up, put flyers in here. Not too many, but, you know, a couple of thousand or so. It's going to be very cold in this cargo hold when we reach cruising altitude, but you'll manage. I'll drop the landing gear over the cities. The papers will drop. Rinse and repeat. Easy peasy."
"And we know it will work?" Hank asked.
"No, but it's the only option. I give it a 90% chance of success. Do I think all the flyers will go out? No. Will most of them? Yes. I have no idea what the coverage will be. Chicago is a big place. People could be on the North Shore, the South Side, or any of the suburbs around the city. We have a very small shot of landing flyers on people. We do a pass. We drop the flyers. Hope the sound of a plane alerts people. They find the instructions. It's all we can do."
Peter shut the door and twisted the handle.
"Any of you want to try it?"
They each took turns opening the door and shutting it. Thick winter gloves and hats sat in a pile next to the door, along with several noise suppression headphones.
"You think Chicago is big. What's our plan for the other places? Houston, Dallas, San Antonio? Los Angeles is massive."
Dan shook his head. "Needle in a haystack to find people."
"We give it a try because it's the right thing." Hank gave Dan's arm a pat. "As Peter says, it's all we can do.
The men stood in the cargo hold. Are you ready, Ahmed? Let's get the show on the road. The rest of you? Seat belts on and seats in their full and upright positions. Yes, sir, Paul told him.